My name is Comrade Michael Pellet. No, my name's Michael Pellet, and I teach at the Lutheran Seminary in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And our topic for today, as we discuss liberation theology, is to look at some of the influences that Marxism and Marxist social analysis has for some theologians of liberation, and to ask why these theologians of liberation are using Marxist analysis in helping them understand theology, who God is, what God does. And to begin this session, again, I would refer you to this booklet by Zephania Kamita, Why, O Lord? And I would like to read for you his understanding of Psalm 27 and how this becomes for him and the people of Namibia a psalm of liberation. And Kamita writes, "The Lord is my light and my liberation. I will fear no so-called world powers. The Lord protects me from all danger. I will never be afraid. When their security forces attack me and try to kill me, they stumble and fall. Even if their whole imperialist armies surround me, I will not be afraid. I will still trust in God, my liberator. I have asked the Lord for one thing only do I want, to be God's instrument in the struggle for liberation, to be driven by God's love. In times of war, God will shelter me. God will keep me safe in loving hands and make me secure on a high rock. So I will triumph over the oppressive regime. With shouts of joy, I will give my life as a sacrifice in your service. I will praise and sing freedom songs to my Lord. Hear me, Lord, when I call to you. Be merciful and answer me. When you said, 'Come and be my servant,' I answered, 'I will come, Lord. Do not hide yourself from me. Do not be angry with me. Do not turn your servant away. You have been my help. Do not leave me. Do not abandon me. O God, my liberator, my father and mother may abandon me, but the Lord will be with me in this present situation and forever. Teach me, Lord, what you want me to do, and lead me along in this difficult situation. Do not abandon me to the worshippers of apartheid and their collaborators who attack me with lies and threats. I know that I will live to see in this present life the Lord's victory over the enemies of the oppressed people in southern Africa. Trust in the Lord. Have faith. Do not despair. Trust in the Lord." To pick up where we left off yesterday and to try to summarize this and pull some things together. Yesterday we were talking about the poor ones. Who are the poor? Why is the term poor or anowim a theological term? And one of the things that seems to be particularly important in talking about the poor ones, or the Hebrew word for this, anowim. Is that it becomes a theological category because it seems that within a particular social, political, cultural, historical situation, there are times that it is only God who still seems to care for the poor. Right? As we looked at the previous day, the levels of liberation, when we see that liberation can be seen on a social, political, economic level, a historical level, and a theological level, we see that at times, because of the structures that happen here at this level and structures that cause injustice, because of structures and culture here at the historical level, that cause oppression because of the root of injustice and oppression. Theologically, we call that sin. We as self-centered human beings, we who as human beings acting out of fear and concern for ourselves, are interested in dominating others and making sure that we are okay at the expense of others, which gives rise to these structures of oppression and injustice. What happens then is that what? We neglect the poor. And that's what makes them God's concern, because we have abandoned them. And yesterday, as we looked at that passage from Mark chapter 14, where Jesus says, "The poor you will always have with you." Why do we always have the poor with us? As we looked back in Deuteronomy chapter 15, and that section of God's law and God's instruction to the people as they enter the land of promise, we find out that the reason there are poor people is because we who are not the poor are not taking care of them. There are poor people because we do not exercise love of God and love of neighbor, but instead, acting sinfully and in unfaith, exercise and establish situations of oppression and injustice. So that there are poor among us is an indictment of us in not taking care of things the way God has asked us to. Yes, you had a question.
Yeah, I wasn't here yesterday. Could you define a poor for us?
Okay. Very briefly, I don't want to go into the whole section of yesterday, but the poor is a category which talks about, it's a distinction from poverty. Right, because poverty basically talks about a particular economic condition. The poor are those who are placed within categories of injustice and oppression. Okay, and so therefore that is a broader ranging category than just poverty. I mean, even today within the United States, right, there's that funny category now called the working poor. I mean, they're not, one would say, destitute or in a situation of poverty, but it's that kind of thing that if the only job you have is a minimum wage job, how can you get together enough money to buy, and let's say you're a single parent mother, How can you get together enough money that pays the rent and feeds and clothes the children and provides things like transportation and all those other things you need? Right? That's called a situation of the working poor. That would fit this category of Anoim. The scriptures, both Old and New Testament, are filled with examples of the Anoim. The classic Anoim from the New Testament, for example, would be Mary. When you think of the Magnificat, that's the song of the Anoim, the poor ones. From the Hebrew scriptures, a classic example of the poor ones is Ruth. I mean, here she is, she's a Moabite widow, had married a Hebrew man, he died without family. Probably her own family had denied her as well because she married out of her tribe or clan. Right, what happens? And yet Ruth, who trusts in God because God is the only one on her side now, no one else is. Right? And we see how God's providential care is at work in Ruth's life. And she meets Boaz and all of that. And then Boaz becomes the exemplar of someone who is a prosperous one, who does care for the poor. And so we have that whole example there. Okay, one more biblical passage that I'd like to point out and look at from the situation of a theology of liberation. And I want to look at this passage since it's the gospel lesson for this Sunday. Those of you who were at the Bible session, the text study yesterday, heard Scott lead us through the parable of the Good Samaritan and concentrate particularly on aspects of being wounded and then healing. I want to take a bit of a different tack with regard to the parable of the Good Samaritan and look at it from the perspective of saying, what character in the story must you become if you want to call this Samaritan good? Why can you call this Samaritan good? Why don't you call him a godless, good-for-nothing, scumbucket Samaritan? Which is what every good Jew would have done. Why is this Samaritan good? Uh-oh, he's not good? It's been a misnomer for all these generations? Go ahead.
Well, on an obvious level, just his deeds would be put in the category of moral virtue or goodness or something along that line.
Maybe. Yeah, but what perspective do you have to take to say he was a good guy? You have to be beaten? You have to be the one in the ditch? I mean, if you take the perspective of the priest or the Levite, I mean, well, maybe the Samaritan isn't good. I mean, the judgment of good with regard to the Good Samaritan comes when we can begin to identify with that person in the ditch, right? With that person on the side of the road. And that makes it, right, that's when you can say all these deeds are good. But no, that places those deeds, I would say, beyond or more than just moral actions. Because one could say that indeed the priest and the Levite were very moral in what they did by passing this victim by. As folks noted yesterday, if these priests and Levites are on the way to Jerusalem, on the way to the temple to worship and to give sacrifices to God, had this victim along the side of the road been dead and they would have touched a dead body, they would have become unclean and had to go through 30 days of ritual and purification and could not worship God the way they were supposed to. So they did the right thing by passing that victim by. They were very upstanding, moral people by not getting involved. And yet, right, we say, but they're not good. They're not good. Well, how can you say that? See, you're always, you know, the great thing about the parables in Jesus as storyteller is he kind of just sucks you right into these stories, is he gets you to identify with someone that you normally do not want to identify with and make a kind of judgment or decision which one usually would not make. And so what Jesus is doing in the parable of the Good Samaritan is pulling us in and saying, you know, like it or not, we have to call this worthless, you know, flea-bitten, immoral, godless schnook, otherwise known as Samaritan, good. And so there you have. And what does it, right? That identification with the victim. And again, that interesting thing about the victim is he is nameless, faceless. There is no identity there, right? Stripped, left for dead. There's no way one even knows who this person, I mean, is this victim Jewish? Is this another Samaritan? Is it somebody? No one knows, right? That's again the other interesting thing about the poor. Right? They have no names. They have no faces. They have no identity. In that sense, as I noted yesterday, we're into the realm of the non-person. And when you have non-persons, it's okay to treat non-persons as non-persons. And the interesting thing about this Samaritan again, why we call him good, is because he treats the non-person as a person, as a human being, as the neighbor. And there again is the interesting and surprising way that God works. Right? The surprising element of grace within this whole situation is that non-persons become persons. And that help, the other side of that, is that help comes from a direction that one least would expect it. Who would have expected that a Samaritan would be the one who would exercise love? Right? Surprise, surprise, surprise. Right? And so here again, at least from the perspective of Latin America and theologians of liberation, as they would look at a parable like the Good Samaritan, they see there again that what is at work is those who identify with the poor and the oppressed, the victims. There again is where the surprising work of God goes on. And there again is something that we can learn to see, you know, back to that passage from Micah. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? And when that happens, one can apply the adjective good to a noun which is so disgusting, like Samaritan. I mean, that's for within the Jewish culture of that time, right? That's an oxymoron. You couldn't put good and Samaritan together. It just doesn't fit. And yet it does. Within this parable, it becomes a way of understanding how God works in the world and who our neighbors are. One other comment on this, from a biblical perspective, and also to bring in something from the churches in South Africa. And that's the understanding that what does this mean again politically, in terms of when one has to oppose the government or forces like the government. And of course, someone will bring up the passage, Romans chapter 13 and following, the passage, just Romans chapter 13, verse 1. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. And so again, the argument is going to say, well, you see, as Christians then, we dare not ever oppose the government which is in authority, because since God has put that government in authority, it is our Christian duty to obey and not to oppose or resist or, God forbid, to engage in revolution against that government. Well, the Kairos document, which is a theological comment on the political crisis in South Africa, addresses that passage. And as a lead into the understanding here about Marxism and Christian liberation, I would like to read for you, it's about a page and a half, what they say about this passage from Romans chapter 13. They write, "The misuse of this famous text is not confined to the present government in South Africa. Throughout the history of Christianity, totalitarian regimes have tried to legitimize an attitude of blind obedience and absolute servility towards the state by quoting this text. The well-known theologian Oscar Kuhlman pointed this out 30 years ago. Quote, as soon as Christians, out of loyalty to the gospel of Jesus, offer resistance to a state's totalitarian claim, the representatives of the state or their collaborationist theological advisors are accustomed to appeal to this saying of Paul, as if Christians are here commended to endorse and thus to abet all the crimes of a totalitarian state, unquote. But what then is the meaning of Romans 13? State theology, and this is again the theology of the state, assumes that in this text Paul is presenting us with the absolute and definitive Christian doctrine about the state. In other words, an absolute and universal principle that is equally valid for all times and in all circumstances. The falseness of this assumption has been pointed out by numerous biblical scholars. See, for example, Ernst Käsemann and Oscar Kuhlmann. Interestingly enough, both of these are Lutheran biblical scholars. What has been overlooked here is one of the most fundamental of all principles of biblical interpretation. Every text must be interpreted in its context. To abstract a text from its context and to interpret it in the abstract is to distort the meaning of God's word. Moreover, the context here is not only the chapters and verses that precede and succeed this particular text, nor is it even limited to the total context of the Bible. The context includes also the circumstances in which Paul's statement was made. Paul was writing to a particular Christian community in Rome, a community that had its own particular problems in relation to the state at that time and in those circumstances. This is part of the context of our text. Many authors have drawn attention to the fact that in the rest of the Bible, God does not demand obedience to oppressive rulers. Examples can be given ranging from Pharaoh to Pilate, and through into apostolic times. The Jews and later the Christians did not believe that their imperial overlords, the Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Greeks, or the Romans, had some kind of divine right to rule them and oppress them. These empires were the beasts described in the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation. God allowed them to rule for a while, but did not approve of what they did. It was not God's will. God's will was the freedom and liberation of Israel. Romans 13 certainly cannot be contradicting all of this. Paul is simply not addressing the issue of a just or unjust state or the need to change one government for another. Paul is simply establishing the fact that there will be some kind of secular authority and that Christians as such are not exonerated from subjection to secular laws and authorities. He does not say anything at all about what they should do when the state becomes unjust and oppressive. That is another question. Consequently, those who try to find answers to the very different questions and problems of our time in the text of Romans 13 are doing a great disservice to Paul. The use that state theology makes of this text tells us more about the political options of those who construct this theology than it does about the meaning of God's word in this text. One biblical scholar puts it, "The primary concern is to justify the interests of the state, and the text is pressed into its service without respect for the context and the intention of Paul." If we wish to search the Bible for guidance in a situation where the state that is supposed to be the servant of God betrays that calling and begins to serve Satan instead, then we can study chapter 13 of the book of Revelation. Here the Roman state becomes the servant of the dragon, the devil, and takes on the appearance of a horrible beast. Its days are numbered because God will not permit this unfaithful servant to reign forever. Okay. So again, it becomes important to think of text and context. And now as we begin to talk about theologians of liberation using some Marxist notions of social analysis, we also have to keep in mind the context in which this is going on. Yes?
10 years ago, I looked at that and thought that Paul was on his way to Spain at the time, as I remember, and he never really got there. He got as far as Rome. And I look at that Romans as Paul writing a letter to the Christians in Rome, knowing full well that the Roman state would know the full content of that letter. That he was addressing the Roman state itself also. And I thought of that people were giving the Romans a hard time by their disobedience due to saying, this is not our kingdom, you are not our kingdom is elsewhere. And so he's telling the church in Rome and the Roman authorities that, hey, you people, you're going to give me a hard time if you give the Romans a hard time. So just don't be so obnoxious to them in that sense. And I think he was writing knowing full well that the Roman state would keep an eye on these people and that they would know the full content of that letter.
Could be. I mean, I think it's very hard to tell the situation. Because Paul writes the letter to the Romans before he ever gets to Rome. It's his letter of introduction, right?
But it's preceding him.
It precedes him.
Hey, I'm a nice guy. Don't cut my head off. They do it anyway, but you know, they kill him.
Yeah.
But I think he was writing a letter knowing that the Roman state would know the content of it.
Yeah, I mean, there again, we just don't have any kind of historical data to know whether it's the Christian congregation or that. From the context of the letter itself, again, and looking at what some of the difficulties are for, or at least what Paul perceives, what he has heard from these Christians in Rome, part of the whole tension is they're saying, well, now that we're Christians, we don't have to obey any of the laws of the state. You know, now that I'm a Christian, just because the speed limit in the state of Washington is 65 or 55 or whatever, big deal. I mean, right? For Christ, God has set me free. You know, so stand fast, therefore, in that freedom. Don't submit again to a yoke of driving 65 miles per hour. You want to go 100, go 100. It's your freedom in Christ. And Paul's saying, wait a second, you know, some government authority, some law, you know, God has put there, I mean, that's the civil or political use of the law. Some laws are good for your own safety. And so don't just kick out anything and everything. Right? Not all government is bad.
Yeah, I think that's
in that sense, Paul is trying to give these folks some practical advice. Right. But again, it's not within that context of what do you do with the oppressive regime. I mean, on the other hand, too, there are all sorts of situations in Paul when the government comes down on Paul and says, listen, Paul, you keep preaching this Jesus stuff and you're going to go to jail. And, you know, Paul says, well, okay, what's my cell number, right? I mean, he's not always just simply Mr. Yes to the government. One makes those kinds of discernments. Okay? To get on a little bit with the understanding here of Marxism. And as usual, we're going to do some terrible things. We're going to look at three very complicated philosophers, Hegel, Feuerbach, and Marx, in 10 minutes. So, of course, we are going to thoroughly cover everything that these key philosophers of the 19th century have said. And if you'd look at your handout sheets, please. This would be under Roman numeral 1. I think I do, yes. I have a few more. Does anyone need some? This way. Over here. Okay. And what I want to do by looking at Hegel, Feuerbach, and Marx is just get a picture of a very predominant kind of historical and social analysis. Under Hegel's dialectic, right, that becomes in many respects, the method or way of understanding how history works. And Hegel's dialectic, to put it very simply, is that Hegel claims that every idea or movement in history has a thesis, right? It has some kind of statement. Along with it, there is an antithesis. It's negation, it's opposite, something that opposes it or is a force working against it. One classic example is he would say, if one looks back at the age of Greece, the golden age of Athens, the thesis is you have the understanding of the Greek citizen, the wonderful Greek citizen. The antithesis to that is that at the same time that you have all these wonderful Greek citizens and philosophers like Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, what would be the antithesis to this? Anyone? Any guesses?
Slavery.
Slavery.
Sparta.
Right? That whole, or Sparta. That whole understanding that, you know, you've got citizens, democracy, and all, but that's very limited. Right? I mean, what makes the Greek city-states run is basically slave labor. And so you have that whole struggle between, if you will, master and slave. And that struggle keeps going until it is worked out in what Hegel says is a synthesis. That synthesis then will become the next thesis, which has its own antithesis, which will be worked out. And you can see then you have kind of this cyclical or spiral notion of history. Others use that to understand the way Christianity worked. For example, you have as the thesis, you say, looking in the New Testament, the Jewish Christians. The antithesis to the Jewish Christians are whom?
Gentiles.
The Gentile Christians, right? And you can see that in the book of Galatians there, that whole conflict, if you will, between Judaizers and Gentile Christians, and do you have to become a Jew in order to be a Christian, and so on and so forth. Well, the synthesis is worked out, and then on and on you go. That's a Hegelian notion of history. It's called the Hegelian dialectic. And it only takes him about 3 books and 700 pages to tell you this. So you know that we've now got every detail, right? Just all I want to say. All right. So what Hegel says here, a couple of his understandings. Reality is the embodiment of rationality in the world. Okay, for what I'm trying to get at there is that Hegel says, or Hegel as an Enlightenment person, believes that there is indeed this great force known as reason, capital R, philosophically. Theologically, you can call it God, right? But that the way that reason works its way into becoming reality is through this system. Right, this is how we get reality. The thesis, antithesis, synthesis, moment, movement in history. Okay, that becomes embodied in the world. History is the process of development and change from less to more perfect forms. I mean, Hegel had the optimistic point of view that as we keep going around in this spiral, we also improve. And so that we are more rational and reasonable than they were back then in master-slave conditions. And finally, therefore, each era or epoch operates due to the commonness of particularly held thoughts. Right? He would say you can categorize each particular era in history by one major kind of dialectical understanding. And so that's why he says you can classify the Greek world, the Roman world, the feudal world, the capitalist world. Feuerbach comes along at the same time as Hegel and a little later. And Feuerbach looks at what Hegel does and says, well, this is great. Hegel's doing all of this with reason, with ideas. Indeed, Hegel is an idealist. He's doing intellectual history. It's all head stuff. And Feuerbach comes along and says, but you know, there's more to reality than just the ideas that flow through our head. There's more to reality than just reason. There's also the material side. And so what Feuerbach does is use this Hegelian dialectic, but gives it a materialist reading in terms of saying, how can we look at this in terms of the stuff that goes on around us? So he says, when you want to talk about God, don't think God is some transcendent being up there, out there, beyond us. God is simply the human reflection upon human modes of existence projected outward. So what we do is from our material world, we look around and say, yeah, we have fathers in our material world, and a wonderful ideal father is, well, let's just project that up there in the heavens and make that God. And we also have utopian notions about how things would be happy and joyful and wonderful. Well, let's just project that up there in the sky and say, heaven. So Feuerbach is saying that basically all religions, Christianity, Hinduism, whatever, are simply the human aspirations and hopes projected out where and then concretized in that form. Secondly, then, he says, history is the struggle of human beings seeking to realize themselves, right, in terms of making all those hopes they have come about, overcoming their self-alienation. And how does one do that? His notion is to change the material order is to change humans and history. In other words, if you change the stuff around you, you are going to be able to change those structures in society and economics and the way you think. And one of Feuerbach's favorite sayings, and it certainly pertains here at Holden, Feuerbach is the one who comes up with the saying in German, man ist, was ist, or in other words, you are what you eat. Yes, it was Feuerbach, right? That's where materialism, the materialist position, has snuck into Holden Village. You are what you eat. I don't know why lentil loaf goes through my mind right now. Egg caca, right? But that, you know, Feuerbach, for example, is one of the first people, you know, again, the university had a very difficult time with supposedly this heady philosopher who was very interested in nutrition, because he believed that if people eat the right foods, it will better their social, political, economic, intellectual conditions. Changing eating habits, right, is going to change a whole bunch of things. And we recognize that. I mean, that is part of the food policy and program here at Holden. So there is that materialist sense. All right. Our buddy Karl Marx comes along, right, after or following upon Hegel and Feuerbach. And basically what Marx tries to do is he combines Hegel's dialectic with Feuerbach's understanding of materialism. And so what Marx is going to claim then is that basically when one tries to change the materialist structure in this kind of dialectic, one will be able finally to realize the ideal, which for Marx was the classless society. But that would come about through changing not, right, what Marx would call the super or suprastructure, which is what an idealist would say, but it comes about through changing the infrastructure. the materialist side, the structures of economics, the modes of production and labor and so on and so forth. And so this becomes what the project of Karl Marx is all about. As I've said in D under Roman numeral 1, theologians of liberation particularly find A3 up there about each era or epoch operates due to the commonness of a particularly held thought, and B3, change material order changes humans in history, particularly useful in analyzing their social, political, economic, and historical situation. Now, why do they find that particularly useful? Just to get at that very quickly, it's because this offers an explanation for conditions of poverty, for conditions of injustice, for conditions of oppression that works against the other thing that they have been hearing for hundreds of years about. Why are you poor? Well, you're poor because it's God's will. You see, that's the way God created you. God created the world such that Europeans have to dominate and be in charge. That's the orders of creation. And so therefore, indigenous people of Latin America, don't fight your poverty. Don't fight your social and economic conditions, because if you do so, you are going against God's will, because it's God's will that you're poor. But that's okay, because as long as you're faithful, you know, you only live a short time here on earth anyways, and then you'll go to heaven and live happily ever after. So that's all right. Earth is a vale of tears. God's will. And so we have then the theology behind that becomes a very fatalistic and deterministic kind of theology that says, don't fight any of this because you're really fighting God. Adopting a Marxist kind of social analysis, right, says, you're poor because it's God's will is a bunch of bunk. You're poor because there are social, economic, political factors at work in the world that are saying, hey, if we exploit and dominate these people, we get more cheap raw materials and resources and are able to bolster and support our economy and live well. So let's do that. And therefore, right, all of a sudden, you take this the economic conditions of poverty and the historical conditions of oppression outside this whole God's will stuff and expose that as bunk and say, no, let's reread scriptures again like we did in the first session to see what is God's will, right? God's will is not that some people are poor and others are rich, right? But God's will is that all share in the bounty and goodness and abundance of creation. And so in that kind of exploitative situation, this analysis enables people to see that and begin to work at changing it.
In your understanding of Latin American history, do you believe this idea that it's God's will that you are poor came from the conquistador or from the priest or from the early church or from both? Because I've discussed this issue with my own pastor, and he's a pretty progressive guy, but he rejected the idea that the peons or the Indians were kept poor because the priests themselves told them that to work and obey the laws because they would be liberated when they died. But in your understanding of Latin history, do you think that came from the Spanish administration, the secular branch, or do you think it came from the church?
It came from both. and the church was split. As we come to the end of this section, I'll talk a little bit about Juan de Sepulveda and Bartolomé de las Casas. De las Casas is, if you will, again, we're talking the middle of the 16th century here, the time of the conquest. De las Casas is, quote-unquote, a theologian of liberation who is protesting the mistreatment of the Indians. Sepulveda, and if you're from Southern California, you know there's a lot of boulevards named after him. Sepulveda is the court theologian of Emperor Charles V, the same emperor of Augsburg Confession fame and everything else. And Sepulveda argues in front of the emperor at a diet in 1550 precisely why conquest is the thing that should be done, because these indigenous peoples are inferior peoples. And there's a classic, a theological disputation that ranges for months there between Sepulveda and Bartolomé de las Casas. It's all recorded, you know, in nice Latin. You can still go to the Vatican Library and read it all, or read it in old Spanish in Madrid if you're thinking, what can I do this weekend? But it's all recorded. Unfortunately, it is not translated into English. But it's all recorded there, the whole debate. Really interesting stuff. And, right, knowing where we're at in history now, we know who also won that debate. Sepulveda won it. And in that respect, you know, to say there are, you know, the church in that sense is split, because there were indeed priests who did not buy into the oppression of the Indians, the native peoples. Again, there are other priests following this line of reasoning and thought who indeed said that this is the proper way to go, that the orders of creation, and that's what Sepulveda argued from, that the orders of creation are such that the European peoples are superior to the inferior indigenous peoples of Latin America, and therefore, right, it is the duty of the Holy Roman Emperor, namely Charles V of Spain, to engage in conquest, right, for what? The salvation of the souls of these inferior people. And old Chuck said, yeah, that sounds pretty good. You win the debate. Let's do that. And that becomes policy. I mean, that's far too glib, but I mean, that's what happens.
A lot of people might be familiar with the movie Mission, and that's
that's that
tension up
there. That shows the kind of tension that's there. Yeah. And again, how even very often, you know, that ironical kind of thing, that even the goodwill and the good intentions of good priests and good people can become oppressive and lead to domination, because the structure becomes a dominating, oppressive structure, which unfortunately the church legitimates and enables to go on. And that's now why liberation theology in Latin America is so volatile, even within the church, and that struggle within the church, and why those in authority have a hard time of figuring out what is the church doing. Because for 400 years, the church has always been legitimating oppression. And now for the last 20 years, they've switched sides. And many folks are saying, hey, that's not fair. You used to be on our side. What happened? And they say, well, you finally understood what the gospel was about. That's what happened. Not playing fair. You know, understanding, no, it's not God's will that these people are oppressed. And there again, this is where the Marxist social analysis becomes helpful. Okay? Roman numeral 2, the Marxist system. Just to elaborate a little bit on what happens when you put together the dialectic of Hegel and Feuerbach's materialism, well, you end up with Marx's dialectical materialism. And what are some key components to that? Under the class struggle, one of the things Marx talks about, the existence of classes is bound up with particular historic phases. Right? Okay, that sounds pretty Hegelian. And so Marx, if you read Das Kapital, all five volumes and fun stuff, right, you come up with what he notes as the five historic phases. The primitive communal, then there's the slave phase, which is like the Greco-Roman world, the feudal stage of the Middle Ages, then the capitalist stage, which Marx said we are presently in, and then his hope was that one would go from the capitalist phase or stage to the socialist communist phase, which is yet to come, the ideal, the classless society. How is one going to go from capitalism to socialism? Well, the change would come, Marx claims, by the quantitative alteration of material conditions that's going to lead to something qualitatively new. Right? Again, that's where the materialist side comes through. If you change quantity, you might get a new quality. And he sees it in this way, that if the means of production heats the masses to poverty, enslavement, exploitation, what happens? The capitalist husk will burst asunder. And that's why, for example, Marx felt that the real change from a capitalist to a socialist society would happen in Great Britain, right? Because that was the most industrialized society of his time, the mid-1800s. It was the society where what? Under labor conditions and everything, poverty, enslavement, exploitation was at its worst, right? Child labor and all that. So he felt that of all places, Great Britain would be the place where one would change from capitalism to socialism. I mean, for example, he would have never thought that the Soviet Union would be the place.
An agrarian society.
No, that the place for this change would have come in the most industrialized societies of the world.
And did he see it as almost an inevitable thing that was on its way not to be stopped?
Sure. It's inevitable that, even now I think that, again, the 19th century is a very optimistic century. It's coming out of the Enlightenment before, the world wars and everything. Folks in the 19th century with the advance of technology, with all this industrialization and whatnot, everybody was thinking things are getting better. And so, Marx felt that definitely the socialist age is going to come. And he was hoping that through his writings, he would be encouraging folks, particularly the proletariat, to rather wait for the nice liberal way of evolving into it, right? If you will, revolutionize your way into it. And, so therefore, workers of the world unite, as the Communist Manifesto said. Don't wait for the gradual Hegelian way of doing it, which he felt would be inevitable, but kind of help the system along a little bit. But he felt for sure that it would come. Again, his metaphors about to alter the quantity will give you a new quality. His favorite metaphor was to say, you put enough heat onto water, and what do you get? Steam. So he was saying, that quantity of heat could give you a new quality, going from water to steam, from liquid to gas. Yes?
He says it was qualitatively new.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say qualitatively better. Because the condition that has seemed to have worked out since the Russian Revolution 1917 is qualitatively different, yes, but not necessarily better. It's all gone straight downhill.
Yeah.
I disagree with that. I think it's certainly much better than it was prior to that.
Yeah.
So in Russia.
It was.
Yeah, that's why I've really been very upset personally with all the headlines in the American newspapers in the last couple of months, particularly preceding May Day and that sort of thing. Communism or socialism has failed throughout the world. But that seems to me a gross misconception. For if we were to look at China and the Soviet Union or Russia prior to their revolutions to see what how the average person lived, you'd have to say that people's lives have improved greatly, in my judgment, through the change to communism, comparing it with what they were before.
Maybe you're saying the Cambodians had more to eat because there were fewer of them.
Well, I'm talking about Soviet Union.
Well, the Soviet Union went through that same sort of process. Mm-hmm.
I think to stick strictly with Marx here, Marx, again, in his context, in his times, certainly believed that the socialist phase would be better than the capitalist phase. Not only new, but new for Marx meant better. And I mean, that again, you see when he's talking about the classless society. I mean, the classless society is better than the capitalist class society of bourgeoisie and proletariat, of owners and workers. Right? See, that's still there. You can see his whole Hegelian thing. What happens? Your thesis is you've got the owners, and they own the means of production, and they've got all the goodies. And over here you've got the workers, and they're alienated from themselves and others and all of that. The synthesis of that, and for Marx, the final synthesis, because this there is no more, as far as he's concerned, is the classless society. And so he's working very carefully to analyze this situation to encourage that synthetic moment to come about. And that's why, I mean, Das Kapital is so careful in economic analysis. Right? And in the second section here under B, just, you know, to say if you read Das Kapital and all that kind of thing, it sometimes you say, boy, this is tedious, boring stuff. Well, of course it is. I mean, that's what a materialist would be very interested in. You know, how are pork bellies doing this week? That's important materialist stuff for analyzing these things. And so he's going to look at the factors of production. What are the raw materials, the tools, the labor skill? Then you look at the relations to production, right? The ownership of property, who owns it, how is that done, so on and so forth. The division of labor, which again, to generalize, he sees in terms of two classes, right? Owners and workers. The modes of production, you analyze that to see how are the modes of production leading to alienation, right? And so on and so forth. The distribution of the fruits of that production. Right? Why is it that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer? And finally, then, a kind of conclusion under that, that the labor theory of value must supplant that of supply and demand. In other words, the value of a product should be in terms of the amount of labor put into it, not simply whether or not the market says, well, since there's not much of this around right now, it can cost more. And so the whole labor theory of value is against the free market supply and demand notion of Adam Smith and others. The superstructure, the three basic categories of the superstructure are religion, morality, law. And for Marx, all three demonstrate that thinking reflection theory comes after the material order has affected the human mind. What does this mean in terms of a concern for theologians of liberation? Number four there, justice represents the will of the economically dominant class to keep the relations of production just as they are, the status quo. Religion's function is to legitimate this order. And so that what becomes justice through Marxist analysis is that justice becomes synonymous with another favorite phrase that we see cropping up in elections all the time, law and order. But here again, social analysis on something is saying, right, when you think about it at times, order and the law that maintains that order may not particularly be just. Right? You cannot always equate justice with law and order. Think about some very obvious example, right? I mean, from the Egyptian point of view, right? Egypt was a great society of law and order until these uppity Hebrews, don't want to live by those laws. So what do you have to do? You got to clamp down on them a little harder so they obey. But, their problem is they're saying, we know, Pharaoh, you've got all sorts of wonderful order. The problem is there's no justice. Or think about slavery in the United States, right? The slave system, it was a wonderful system of law and order, right? Everybody knew their place. The only problem is these uppity blacks were saying, but it's not, there's no justice here. Right? Or civil rights movement, all sorts of law and order, right? Blacks sit in the back of the bus, but Rosa Parks says, my feet's as tired, I'm sitting in the front. So much for order. And all of a sudden, others think, what about justice for people with tired feet? And so here in Latin America and other places like this, the social analysis helps one to see that law and order is not necessarily justice. And so therefore, right, to talk about justice might mean, and to be on the side of justice might mean that one is radically opposed to the law and order of governments, of Pinochet in Chile, of Somoza in Nicaragua, of U.S. regimes, who knows where, of apartheid in South Africa. Rolf, you had a...
In a wonderful illustration of that sense that depends on from which perspective you come in defining your terms, in a little restaurant in our community, there's a cartoon up on the wall with a number of people well-heeled clearly at a cocktail party, and one person is saying, justice? Well, justice? Yes, I believe in just us.
Yeah. Well, sure.
In this perspective, just us is justice.
Just us is justice.
It sounds so dumb, but I want to be clear about what a Marxist position would be on law and order.
Okay. What I'm saying here is not particularly trying to say what the Marxist position is on law and order, but how using Marxist or Marxist technique of social analysis, it enables us to see that law and order might be part of the way in which oppression and exploitation takes place and therefore is not justice.
Okay.
See? So in other words, one can use a Marxist analysis. You can see, right, the interesting thing here is you can also use Marxist analysis against Marxist